Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dr. Tom Kranewitter, president of Speak Easy Ideas, and this is a special address, a special podcast of sorts for the members of Vino and Veritas at Castle Rock. This last weekend was supposed to be our 12th and concluding meeting discussing the Federalist Papers, and we had to postpone it. And we apologize again. It was really because of me. I was down with a nasty cold and that became a sinus infection. And by golly, that thing just dragged on and it took me forever to get over that thing. Anyway, we're doing a makeup session Sunday evening, March 1st at Colorado Cork and Keg, same place and time. And we're hoping that all or most of you will be there. But just in case, if some of you cannot attend, I wanted to offer this audio recording of some of the major topics that I wanted to cover during our wrap-up concluding discussion of the Federalist Papers. And I really hope that you've enjoyed this sort of unusual club that we've put together. I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but you now number among the very few of your fellow citizens who have actually read through and studied and talked about the Federalist Papers. It's a book that is mostly ignored and rarely ever looked at by students or scholars or citizens. It's also, I mentioned this the very first time we met, and it's worth repeating now, I certainly rank the Federalist Papers among the great books of the Western canon. It's an unusual entry into that list, to be sure, and yet it really represents a uniquely American treatise of political theory, and I think certainly offers insights, philosophic, historical insights into the human condition that is on par with anything you'll find in, you know, John Locke or Algernon Sidney or many of the other great modern thinkers. And as a great book, it's worth going back to. What you'll find with great books in general and the Federalist Papers in particular is as you become more familiar with it, you will start to notice nuances and details and subtle reflections and insights that you might have passed over before. And therefore, when you return to the Federalist Papers for the second time, the third time, the fourth time, each time you as the reader, you as the student, will walk away from the book with a broader, deeper, bigger understanding of serious subjects related to human nature, constitutional government, the challenge of a just society that rests on the consent of the governed, than ever before. And I encourage you to do that. I wanted to pick up here, since this is our concluding discussion on the Federalist Papers, by reading just a little bit from the very last number. There, sorry, I've got a little frog in my throat here. Remember, there are 85 essays that make up the Federalist Papers. So I'm going to turn to number 85. This is about halfway through. I'm on page 523 in my Signet Classic Edition. Middle paragraph. Publius writes, "I answer in the next place that I should esteem it the extreme of imprudence to prolong the precarious state of our national affairs and to expose the Union to the jeopardy of successive experiments in the chimerical pursuit of a perfect plan." So he's saying that the state of the Union in, this would be in the spring of 1788, the state of the Union is a state of precariousness. And it doesn't make sense to prolong that precarious condition of the American Union in the pursuit of a perfect plan. That is, if someone says, look, this proposed constitution, the constitution that came out of the convention of 1787, it's not worthy of adoption because it is less than perfect. Publius is pushing back against that and saying, you know, that's actually not a reason to reject it because it's not perfect. He goes on and says, I never expect to see a perfect work from imperfect man. The result of the deliberations of all collective bodies must necessarily be a compound, as well as of the errors and prejudices, as of the good sense and wisdom of the individuals of whom they are composed. Right, put together any kind of deliberative or collective body of people, and what are you going to find? You're going to find human beings, and yes, they possess some good sense, they have some wisdom, and they also make errors, right? And they also have prejudices, and they make mistakes in their thinking and their reasoning. And so any human body, right, any institution, any collection of a deliberative group of people, the result is going to be a compound. It's probably going to have some wisdom in it. Whatever the result is, it's going to have some good sense, and it's going to have some errors. It's going to reflect some prejudices, because those are the human beings who created whatever the results were of that deliberative body. He goes on and concludes this paragraph. The compacts, which are to embrace 13 distinct states in a common bond of amity and union, must as necessarily be a compromise of as many dissimilar interests and inclinations, right? The 13 original states, they're each very different from each other, right? The culture, the way of life, the interest pursued in, I don't know, say South Carolina is very different than the culture, the interest pursued, the way of life in Massachusetts. And so any kind of compact that is going to apply to all 13 is going to be some sort of compromise of all those different interests and inclinations. And he ends this paragraph with a question. How can perfection spring from such materials? It's a rhetorical question, right? I mean, the point is, perfection cannot spring from such materials. And so it's it is imprudent, it is unwise to hold up a relatively reasonable, relatively wise, relatively good constitution in the pursuit of a perfect constitution. Because we're never going to get a perfect constitution. Not so long as it comes from the minds and pens of human beings. We're not going to get constitutional perfection. And so let us lower our sights from perfection to what's the best we can achieve right here and right now. This is a very tangential point. I'll just toss it out for your consideration. But his remark here reminds me of many contemporary criticisms, meaning today, in our modern politics of the United States. It is certainly true that the United States as a regime, the history of the United States, falls far short when it is measured against the standard of perfection, right? Moral, philosophic, intellectual perfection. If you imagined a country run by angels, for example, the United States has fallen far short of that standard. But here's the thing. When compared to all other actual regimes, real nations, real countries, real tribes and clans and principalities that have existed over thousands of years, real human beings, run by real human beings, then the United States all of a sudden looks pretty good. It's up there either at the top or near the top when compared to other actual regimes. I would say the same thing about our Constitution. Falls short of the standard of perfection, but compared to any other constitution that's ever been designed by human beings. I personally don't know of one that is more filled with insight into the human condition and both philosophic and historic wisdom. And I'll put out a challenge. If someone knows of a constitution wiser, juster than the United States Constitution of 1787, show it to me. I would love to know what that constitution is. And so this teaching here, this paragraph is kind of a pivot in the last number toward the subject of moderation. And if you recall, that theme of moderation was prominent right up front. We encountered it, in fact, in the very first essay, Federalist Papers number one, to moderate, you know, one's expectations from politics. If you expect too much from the political realm, if you expect politics to present all solutions to all problems, you're likely to be disappointed. And that's an unrealistic expectation of politics. And so right up front, Publius was encouraging the reader toward moderation, right? Lowering your expectations, not getting rid of all expectations, right? Not saying abandon all standards, just lower the standards down to what's reasonable, what's practicable within the human realm. And he picks up, he develops this theme in the rest of, it's really the concluding theme of Federalist number 85. I want to turn to the last paragraph of number 85. So this is the concluding paragraph to the Federalist Papers. Begins on page 526, about the middle of the page. And Publius writes, there's a long, lengthy quotation here. We won't read all of that. Jump down about, 10, 12 lines down into that paragraph on page 526 after the quotation. He writes, he's quoting from Hume there, "These judicious reflections by Hume contain a lesson of moderation to all the sincere lovers of the Union and ought to put them upon their guard against hazarding anarchy, civil war, a perpetual alienation of the states from each other, and perhaps the military despotism of a victorious demagogue in the pursuit of what they are not likely to obtain but from time and experience. It may be in me a defect in political fortitude, but I acknowledge that I cannot entertain an equal tranquility with those who affect to treat the dangers of a longer continuance in our present situation as imaginary. A nation without a national government is, in my view, an awful spectacle. The establishment of a constitution in time of profound peace by the voluntary consent of a whole people is a prodigy, to the completion of which I look forward with trembling anxiety. I can reconcile it to no rules of prudence to let go the hold we now have in so arduous an enterprise upon 7 out of the 13 states, and after having passed over so considerable part of the ground, to recommence the course." What he means there is, by the time the last of the Federalist Papers were written and published, already 7 states had ratified the proposed Constitution. Remember, it required 9 for the Constitution actually to take effect. At the very end here, he says, "I dread the more the consequences of new attempts, because I know that powerful individuals in this and in other states are enemies to a general national government in every possible shape." A couple things here worth pointing out in this last paragraph. Right after this lesson of moderation he mentions, a number of evils that can befall the United States, anarchy, civil war, perpetual alienation, all these which could be the result of a victorious demagogue. And a curious note about that word demagogue: it appears only twice in the Federalist Papers. number 1 and number 85. Now, isn't that curious? Was that deliberate? Was that purposeful by Hamilton in his big design? I don't know. I can't prove that. I think it's too coincidental simply to be by chance that this book, which addresses the great challenge, the great human challenge of combining the consent of the governed with justice, with equal protection of the equal natural rights of all citizens, that book opens and closes, literally, at the very beginning and the very end, with the subject of demagoguery. I look at that and I think, you know, one way to interpret that is to say the challenge of constitutional self-government, right? If the whole book of the Federalist Papers is filled with instruction on basically how to be a self-governing constitutional republic, that challenge of being a self-governing constitutional republic is, in the Federalist Papers, literally surrounded by the threat of demagoguery. There will always be demagogues. There will always be those who will flatter the people, lie to the people, try to bribe the people, promise the people things they cannot possibly deliver, all in the hopes of getting more power for themselves, all in the hopes of subverting the Constitution's authority over the Republic, all in the hopes of misleading, misdirecting the American people. And so it speaks to, I think, an important theme of the Federalist Papers, which is in a decisive respect. I'm not saying we should not care at all about who gets elected to various positions in government. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying it's irrelevant or unimportant. It is. But in a decisive respect, allegiance to the Constitution, our allegiance, we, the American people, to have allegiance to the Constitution and the form of government and the processes it prescribes is more important than allegiance to any person, to any politician, to any political candidate. Political candidates will come and go. They'll get into office, they'll get voted out of office. You know, they're born, they live, and they die. But the Constitution will endure. And the Constitution, if adhered to by the people and the public servants they elect, will go a great distance in warding off the ever-present danger of demagoguery, right? A danger that is sort of woven into the human condition because it's woven into human nature. A few more themes here I wanted to touch upon just a little bit as you reflect upon the Federalist Papers in the last 12 months, talking about them, reading them. If you remember back in number one, Federalist Paper number one, Publius presented this unusual phrase that he said that he was going to tell the truth, and then he said, he sort of qualified that. He backed up just a little bit. He said, well, at a minimum, he would not embarrass the truth, which is a slightly, right, that's a little different thing than saying, I'm just going to tell, right, the whole truth, the full truth exactly as it is, to say, I'm going to make arguments and say things that at least won't embarrass the truth. And we started to get some sense of what that means when, if you remember when we arrived at Federalist Paper number 10, and Publius said there that the key distinction between ancient political science and modern political science, the modern political science of the Federalist Papers, is that the ancients did not know about representation. They had no idea what that was. They didn't incorporate it. They didn't use it. That every self-governing regime in the ancient world was some form of direct democracy, right? such as the Athenian Assembly, right, where Athenian citizens would show up and legislate themselves. They would vote on whatever pressing public matters of the day were, a law, a judicial trial, whatever it was. So that was his statement in number 10, no representation in the ancient world. And then when we got to number 63, right, much, much later in the book, and you know, in number 10, he's praising modern political science, modern political thought, modern political people like the American people, say, look, you're so much more sophisticated than those ancient political thinkers. They didn't even know about representation. We know about it. We can adopt it and incorporate it into our constitutional design. Then when we get back to number 63, this is in the context of the discussion of the Senate. Well, there, Publius basically admits that what he said in number 10 was an untruth. It wasn't true. That actually, there were a number of ancient regimes that knew about representation and actually incorporated it into their ancient constitutions, into their forms of government. And this is, he sets it up for this sort of big announcement that this is too startling. This is too, well, to use a political phrase, this is too undemocratic, small d, undemocratic or unpopulist, an announcement to make early in the book. He would have lost most of his readers and followers if he had made this announcement early in the book. So he saves this till much later. In 63, where he says, look, the real distinction between ancient political science and the modern political science of the Constitution, it's not representation. Turns out the ancients knew about representation, and many of them incorporated representation into their regime. There's a different distinction, and this time he's being fully honest. He says the real distinction is, in every ancient self-governing regime, the mass of people were provided some venue where they could come and actually administer the government themselves, right? Actually decide on laws and government matters themselves directly. There was some mechanism for that. And in the proposed U.S. Constitution, the people, meaning the mass of people, the millions of citizens, U.S. citizens, they are excluded from administering or exercising the powers of government directly. We commented when we were talking about that in our meeting, you know, it's a curious thing. The Constitution provides for a House of Representatives. It does not provide for a House of the People. There is no equivalent to the ancient Athenian Assembly under the U.S. Constitution, right? So that the actual exercise of constitutional powers is done entirely by representatives, either direct representatives, such as members of the House, or indirect representatives, like members of the Senate, the President, and to some degree, members of the judicial branch. And the reason for this is the theme that it runs throughout the Federalist Papers, but it becomes much more pronounced in the later part of the book. The theme is that the greatest danger to the American people is the American people. And not because they're American, because they're human. The greatest threat to any large group of people is a large group of people. It really is a reflection on psychology, the difference between individual psychology or the psychology of a small group versus the psychology of masses of people, the psychology of a mob. Right? The idea is a mob is not reasonable. A mob is not rational. A mob typically does not pursue justice, right? Because justice quite often requires all kinds of, you know, understanding all kinds of nuances and details. Who deserves what and who's to blame for what and, right, so on and so forth. mobs typically just want to satisfy their passion. They want to vent their anger. That's what mobs do. And more often than not, mobs engage in injustice, even as they're out there proclaiming justice, saying that they're marching or, you know, burning down houses in the name of justice. So that insight into human nature, that large numbers of people, you get thousands, much less millions of people together acting in concert, the results are not likely to be good. They're much, much, much more likely to be bad, to be unjust, to be irrational, unreasonable, unwise, imprudent. And so you see throughout the design of the Constitution, as presented in the Federalist Papers, this avoidance of any large group of people. Think of the discussion of the House of Representatives, the biggest, most populous part of the national government. And even there, you know, Publius warns, he says, look, remember he has that line, he says, 60 or 70 men may be a safer depository for power than six or seven, right? Because if you grant a lot of power to some Congress that's only six or seven men, well, there's not very many to bribe or corrupt. So 60 or 70 is a safer, right? It makes the work of corruption more difficult just because there's more people to bribe and corrupt. But then he goes on and says, however, we cannot carry out the same reasoning to say 600 or 700 would be better. And he says, certainly when you go farther to 6,000 or 7,000, it's reversed. It actually becomes more dangerous because 6,000 or 7,000 people in one room, that's no longer a deliberative legislative body. That's a mob. And the mob's going to do all kinds of intemperate, impassioned, unjust things that mobs tend to do. So we want government by small bodies of citizens who are representative, right? They're representing the other citizens, but they find themselves in institutions where they can calmly, coolly talk and listen and think and debate, right? And reflect in the exercise of government power. So even the House, Publius recommends that it not get very large. It's the great benefit of a Senate. The Senate will be, you know, proportionately smaller than the House. And even then, even with these small deliberative bodies, we still need something like a judicial branch with the power of judicial review to correct unconstitutional measures that might be passed out of intemperance and impatience and injustice in the elected and more representative bodies of the national government. This really is the esoteric, hidden, or at least, you know, partly concealed teaching of the Federalist Papers. And I think it makes sense when you consider how proud the Americans were of being, you know, democratic, self-governing people. They governed themselves. They adopted their own constitutions at the state levels. They were self-governing people. And yet what Publius is offering here is a very undemocratic insight and recommendation. And he's presenting that in a way that he hopes his readers will agree with and accept, but he also spends a lot of time buttering them up and flattering them and telling them how wise and great and virtuous they are and how great they are at governing themselves before he comes out and reveals that insight. And we see this, that theme, the danger of large bodies of people acting on an impulse. We see that in the essays on the House, the essays on the Senate, the essays on the executive branch, and the essays on the judiciary. It runs throughout those later numbers of the Federalist Papers. Another sort of big topic here I wanted to wrap up with is just to emphasize to you, your careful readers of the Federalist Papers, your serious men and women, Otherwise, you wouldn't join a group like the Vino and Veritas Club at Castle Rock. And so I want to emphasize truly the great challenge of combining the consent of the governed with justice, with the reality, right? Combining the consent of the governed with the reality that the governed, very often, meaning the masses of citizens, very often, you know what they give their consent to? They give their consent to injustice. Not always, but often. And in a way, this is the core nub. This is the nut to be cracked. This is the problem to be solved. How do you have a government by consent and justice at the same time? How do you avoid injustice being, you know, authorized by the consent of the majority? The whole Constitution is designed to mitigate that problem. The whole Constitution, you know, you see this really clearly when you get to the discussion of the judiciary, an entirely unelected branch of the national government with the power to check the more popular, you know, the elected branches. The judiciary is separate. It's independent precisely because the governed very often consent and authorize injustice. And so the solution here, it's in a way simple. In theory, it's simple. In practice, it's turned out to be really difficult, almost impossible to maintain. The solution is you create a government based on the consent of the governed. Right? It has no authority except for that authority, that power that the people, we the people, give to it. And at the same time, the people are consenting, the same time that the people are authorizing the creation of a government, they authorize a government that limits the direct involvement of the people. And in a way, that's one of the challenges of the Federalist Papers. How do you persuade people to consent to ratify, to authorize the creation of government, of a government in which the people do not have any direct involvement in the exercise of power? Yes, we can elect representatives, but we the people don't pass bills. We the people don't sign bills into laws, right? We the people don't render verdicts in particular cases. That's left to those we select to put into government. So you create a government by consent of the governed. You ask the people, we the people, to consent to authorize a government that greatly limits the direct involvement of the people. And then you limit the powers that government may exercise, right? Only a few powers we the people actually grant to those in government. Yes, we the people, the masses, we do not directly exercise the powers of government. And those who do directly exercise the powers of government, meaning members of the House and the Senate, right, and the President and the Supreme Court, the powers that we've granted them are very few. It's not like we said, hey, you few, go run our lives. Go rule over every aspect of our lives and our property and our business and the education of our children and our medicine and everything. No, we didn't say that. We said, we the people are going to stay out of the exercise of government powers. You few that we select, you're going to exercise them. And it's greatly limited. Those powers are enumerated. And if there's a power that we the people didn't give you in government, then you don't have it. You don't get to exercise it. That combination, government by consent, think of it as three pieces. One, government by consent. Two, limit the direct involvement of the people. And three, limit the powers that those in government may exercise. That combination tends to limit most injustices to the private realm. And injustices in the private realm, however bad they would be, I mean, let's be real clear here, things like, right, theft and rape and murder, I mean, those can be terrible injustices. But as long as injustices are in the private realm, they tend to be far less extensive and far less dangerous than when governments engage in injustice, right? Murder's terrible. We would all agree to that. Murder's terrible. It's a horrific human injustice. But which is worse, an individual who murders one or two or three or four or five people, or dozens, or a government that sets up death camps and murders millions, murders so many that researchers squabble with each other trying to count them because no one knows the exact number because the number is so gigantic. You see here, you know, we were talking before about not expecting perfection. Here's an example, right, of the moderation. It's to confront a reality. It says, look, there'll always be injustice among human beings. And injustices in the private realm tend to be less extensive, less dangerous. There's a government there to protect your rights. There's a government there to protect those who do injustices in the private realm. That's why every state has reserved to its powers the power to form a criminal code and enforce it. And citizens, individual citizens should be feisty and spirited and prepared to protect themselves and protect their families. And this is sort of the hard teaching of the political science of the founding. That's about the best you can do in terms of your private realm, right? Have a government that enforces a good, solid criminal code, you know, says murders is illegal and theft is illegal and so on and so forth, and have individual citizens armed and prepared and willing, spirited, feisty, to defend themselves, to protect themselves, to take on anyone who threatens them individually. That's about the best. That is the safest the world is ever going to be for human beings. And that is far better, right? For those of you thinking, well, that sounds really dangerous. I don't know if I want to live in that dangerous world. Well, the alternative is to grant way far more power to the government. And when government has much greater powers, it's much easier for governments to engage in injustices. And when injustices are committed by governments, right, which are back, that is law enforced violence. Government violence tends to be far exponentially worse than injustices in the private realm. All of which is a reason for a constitutionally limited government coupled with feisty, spirited citizens willing and able to take care of themselves, protect themselves. Finally, last point here I want to make about our exercise reading through the Federalist Papers. I hope that I've been helpful enough that you feel somewhat comfortable reading through the Federalist Papers on your own. In fact, maybe even doing something like what I've done for others, being a coach, being a tutor, being a mentor, just helping someone work their way through the Federalist Papers. And I'll offer this piece of encouragement. If you ever find yourself with the opportunity, you know, maybe it's one of your children, maybe it's a friend, whomever. If you have the opportunity to coach someone through the Federalist Papers, jump on it, take it. You will love it. And one of the things you'll likely experience is however much you help the other person learn from the Federalist Papers, you yourself will learn much more. It will be one of the greatest learning experiences of your life. And one of my goals here is to, there's a word that gets overused and it's become kind of cheesy. I'm reluctant to use it, but I'll use it anyway. It's to empower you. I want you to feel empowered. I want you to feel confident, comfortable working your way through the Federalist Papers on your own and actually helping others, pointing out, you know, insights, pointing out how pieces of the book relate to each other. And this is because, in a way, even more importantly, I want to empower you, fellow citizens, I want you to be confident, not just reading through the Federalist Papers on your own, but reading through the Constitution on your own. Read the Constitution. Reread it. The thing's not long. It really isn't. There's only 7 articles in the original Constitution. And, other than Article 1, Section 8, most of those sections in those 7 articles are real short. Most of them are like one paragraph. Read through your Constitution. Get to know it. Don't wait for experts to tell you what your Constitution means. It's not right for self-governing citizens to say, well, I don't know what my Constitution means. I need some bureaucrat to tell me. I need some regulator. I need some lawyer. I need some judge. I need some, legislator to tell me what my Constitution means. When we get to that point where we're dependent upon those in government to tell us what our Constitution means, then self-government's over. Freedom's lost at that point. The point is, that's our Constitution. That's your Constitution. You're part of we the people. You authorized it, right? We the people do ordain and establish this Constitution. You authorized it. Study it. Know it. Be willing to stand up when those in government get it wrong. Say, no, bub, you're wrong about that. That's not what the Constitution means. And I don't care if it's some fancy degreed, special counsel or independent investigator or a member of the United States Supreme Court or a member of Congress or a member of your state legislator or a governor. When they get it wrong, we the people need to be ready and able to say, no, that's actually not what our Constitution means. And in the end, in a decisive respect, we the people, we're the judges of what our Constitution means. Yeah, we know all about judicial review. We studied Federal 78. But in a decisive respect, we the people decide what the Constitution means. And if the court gets it wrong, we will instruct our lawmakers to correct that mistake, or we'll amend it, or we will find a solution to it. When the Supreme Court, for example, says, oh yeah, the Constitution authorizes all these independent regulatory agencies, so they're fine, right? We the people are perfectly free to say that is bullhooey. They're not constitutionally acceptable. It's not all fine. And we are going to kick out of Congress everyone who thinks they are, and we're going to select members of Congress who will start repealing and abolishing these unconstitutional abominations, right? There's nothing stopping us from doing that. And it doesn't matter what any Supreme Court opinion has to say about it. That's part of the goal here. There's a social aspect to our Vino and Veritas clubs. We think people like hanging out together and getting to know one another. We certainly have enjoyed it. We hope you've enjoyed it. It's been wonderful spending time with you. And there's an educational part to it. We selected a serious book with some serious themes and topics in it. And we hope that you learn something and you'll share that with others. And in the end, there's a civic purpose to this. There's a political purpose to this. There's a self-government purpose to this. We want to empower and inspire confidence into fellow citizens to own their Constitution, to become the masters, to become the authorities. If we can do that, we can actually recover constitutional government in the United States, and we can transform this country of ours into a beacon of freedom for the entire world to see and admire. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for letting me and letting my team at Speakeasy Ideas share some time with you this last year. It's been a great honor. Have a great rest of your day.